Betsy Dirksen Londrigan wants to represent Illinois' 13th district in Congress, and to do that, she'll need to unseat Republican Congressman Rodney Davis. Today, we sit down with the Democratic candidate.
The tipping point for me getting into this race is very personal. It is because I saw Rodney Davis and Donald Trump and all their cronies celebrating in the White House on the day they passed Trump Care out of the House.
Plus, did you know Chicago has the worst recycling rate in the country? Later this hour, we'll talk to the Better Government Association about its investigation into the city's problematic recycling program. And how much has technology changed not just our politics and culture, but our daily lives? The Irish artistic duo Kennedy Brown joins us to talk about their new exhibit at the Krannert Art Museum.
We're in the matrix, so to speak, to be kind of hackneyed about it. We're implicated in this. We use technology. Technology uses us.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, we'll learn more about why Chicago has the lowest recycling rate of any major city in the country and ask what the rest of the state looks like. And the Irish artistic duo Kennedy Brown joins us to talk about their first U.S. exhibition right here in Illinois. But first, we're fast approaching Election Day. A reminder, early voting has already started, and you can register to vote anytime, even on Election Day on November 6th. In the 13th Congressional District, Betsy Dirksen Londrigan is the Democratic candidate. The district covers all or part of 14 different counties across central and southwestern Illinois, including Bloomington, Urbana, and Springfield. She is running against Representative Rodney Davis, who has been in office for three terms and whom we spoke with last week. Dirksen Londrigan has worked as a fundraiser for politicians, including our current U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, as well as the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library Foundation. She lives in Springfield and joins us from our partner station, WUIS, there now. Betsy Dirksen Londrigan, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
You've never held public office before. What makes you confident that you're ready for this job to represent Illinois and Washington?
You know, my whole life is invested right here in the 13th District. And I have made a point of getting around the district. I've actually held, you know, recently in the last couple of months, 14 town halls, all open and free to the public. I did one in every county. And Democrats, Republicans, independents, you know, you name it, they attended. And I have my finger on the pulse of the people in our district because I'm the one standing in front of them and asking for their priorities and what's on their minds. And, you know, I always tell people a funny thing happens when you stand in front of groups of people and ask what's on their minds. They tell you. And so they've given me a very clear directive of what they want from their representative in Washington, D.C.
One of those issues that's a very important thing to you and also we've been hearing a lot from voters is health care. And that's something you've talked a lot about during the campaign. You've said you want to fix the Affordable Care Act. What does that mean?
So the GOP that's in Congress right now has done everything they can because they couldn't repeal the ACA and all the essential health benefits that go along with it. They have just chipped away at it and caused it to destabilize. And, you know, people are seeing it because insurance premiums have gone up. And what I want to make sure that we do is look at the ACA as what it is supposed to be, a first step. And make sure that it's functioning the way it should and that all of these essential health benefits like coverage for people with pre-existing conditions and making sure that they don't get discriminated against by insurance companies are all held in place.
And when we think about all of those individual steps, what are the first steps you think we need to take here? Those are a lot of different things you've mentioned there.
Well, I mean, protecting the essential health benefits is something that people from, you know, that I hear about all the time. They want to make sure that if they have a pre-existing condition, you know, in fact, in our district, almost 300,000 people have pre-existing conditions. And so making sure that insurance is affordable for them and that they can't be discriminated against is a top priority.
And when we're talking about making things affordable, I know you've said that you support a public option for health insurance, which would compete with private insurers. Why do you think that's the best way to lower premiums for families?
Well, because we know that that Medicare works, and introducing it as a public option to rural and smaller communities and small business owners would be particularly helpful to the 13th District. And that's what I hear from people. The struggles that I hear from them predominantly come from our rural and smaller communities and our small business owners who struggle. And, this is an idea that's already out there. And I just think for our district, it'd be a great fit, and it would help drive costs down for people.
We had your opponent on the 21st last week. He talked about how proud he was of the federal tax cut that Congressman Davis voted for, that he voted for, and that President Trump signed into law. And in the past, Congressman Davis has pointed to our low unemployment rate as proof that the tax cut is working. Is it?
Not for the people in the district that are talking to me. And I am all over the district standing in front of people and listening. What that tax bill really was just a giveaway to corporations and special interests and the super wealthy people that I apparently don't know. And, what people really need is tax reform that is built for the middle class, because I believe that's how we build our economy, is from the middle class out. And, I shared this story the other night, but it reminds me every week on Monday mornings. Our campaign office is by a U.S. Bank trustee's office. And so every morning on Mondays, we see people who are lined up outside that office because they're there to declare bankruptcy. And so we put out chairs for them and try and be as kind as possible, because we're in a horrible situation. That's what I see. And I hear from people at town halls across the district who are struggling to make ends meet. This tax reform wasn't for them. They know it. And frankly, Congressman Davis knows it too.
So when you're thinking about income tax rates, would you be in support of raising tax rates for our wealthier citizens and residents?
Yeah, the tax reform that they put in place, 83% of the benefits went to corporations and super wealthy people and special interest groups. That's completely upside down. We need to make sure that any tax reform that we put forward really builds a middle class.
And when we're thinking about building the middle class, that's something you've talked a lot about. Can you give me specifics of ideas of things you think are important to work on, and particularly when we're thinking about growing jobs in towns like Decatur?
Absolutely. President Trump has put out a $1.5 trillion infrastructure plan, and it's been sitting on ice while, and right now, the Republicans hold all three branches of government, and they didn't have the political will to get this infrastructure plan passed through that would have created great jobs right here in the 13th District. The Midwest Inland Port over in Decatur has an amazing opportunity to really create an economic boom that is going to, that would stretch up to Bloomington Normal and over to Champaign-Urbana and over here to Springfield. I want to see people put forward an infrastructure plan and then fund it and bring those jobs and those dollars right back here to the 13th District.
So certainly we've seen some infrastructure funding that has gone through. I'm thinking of things like transportation and a lot of the dollars that have been funneled to the Chicago area to help with that. Are you saying that not enough has happened for the 13th District?
Right. When I go to Washington to represent our neighbors and our communities, I am going to be fighting for Central Illinois. Because Decatur is one example. Over in Jersey County, there's plans in place that would create even more jobs over there and another logistics hub by expanding the highway over there. So we've got areas around the district, whether it's roads, whether it's bridging that digital divide that we still have in the 13th District, to make sure that our smaller communities are connected to the world around them. We have so many infrastructure needs. And what the people in the 13th District want is they want somebody who is going to Washington, D.C. to really fight for them.
My guest is Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan, who is the candidate for the 13th Congressional District. She is the Democratic nominee. I wonder what your position is on the trade tariffs that were recently enacted by the Trump administration. Do you think they're good for the 13th District?
No, absolutely not. I hear from farmers all the time that that the wait and see approach that Congressman Davis has taken, it does not work for them. Right now, Illinois stands to lose $4 billion in exports and $1 billion of soybeans. And here we are. in the heart of soybean country. Our farmers who have soybeans have lost 20 to 25% of their crop price since March. And now they're worried about their markets coming back. And that's what they really want. You know, I understand that there's a bailout. The farmers understand that, too. That's not what they want. They want markets to sell to. And their livelihoods are at risk. And they don't feel like they've got somebody standing up for them.
I want to ask you about immigration. There are lots of things that are wrong with our system. Congressman Davis, though, has voted for bills that would include a path to legal residency for DACA recipients and funding for a border wall. Would you have done the same and voted for both of those?
No, I am 100% for a fair, humane, earned path to citizenship. Absolutely. And I am against abolishing ICE. We do need border security and we do need trained officers. But what I am not for is for spending money on a border wall on the southern border that then leaves our other borders, you know, exposed and really is nothing more than it's gimmicky. You know, we've got great technology that we can employ to secure our borders and make sure that the people that are coming across, if they are, you know, that if they are refugees, you know, that's one thing. If they're coming across illegally, then that has to be dealt with.
I'm thinking in terms of immigration also of the children who are separated from their families at the border. There's so many things that we could talk about this year as well. You mentioned refugees, a lack of legislation to protect Dreamers, as I was just talking about. What would be your top priority when it comes to immigration reform?
Well, we've got, you know, we have to admit that both parties have failed on immigration reform. And this needs to be a bipartisan approach. But we as Americans we can never be the nation that separates families at the borders. That's not who we are, and that cannot be acceptable. And so making sure that we, again, that we remember who we are and that we treat people humanely and that we do work toward this earned path to citizenship.
And so what steps would you take to do that?
Well, I mean, we need to protect the Dreamers. We need a clean DACA bill. We do need border security. I am against abolishing ICE, but we need reform. And I want us to be able to use our technology to help secure the borders. But it just doesn't come in the form of a wall. Again, I just think it's gimmicky. It costs a lot of money.
Sorry to interrupt you. Yeah,
but that's okay.
As we're talking about a lot of different issues that voters have been surfacing to us, one thing I've heard a lot about is climate change. I wonder if you can name two things Congress should be doing to work to reduce climate change.
Well, absolutely. First of all, we should not have left the Paris Climate Accord. You know, we have historically been leaders in how to address climate change, and I think the world looks to us for that leadership, and I think that was a mistake. And then, you know, we also need to make sure that we're addressing what the EPA is doing and the rollbacks that have taken place, because I do believe that clean water, clean air, and clean land are human rights.
The past few weeks, the confirmation of Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh has really been something that has, I think, captured the entire country's attention, as well as been something that is very divisive. And when we look at what happened in Washington, the final vote was almost entirely along party lines. And I wanted to ask just first about what you think right now in terms of conversations, statements that have been made about the partisan nature of the statements he made during his confirmation process, and if you're worried now about the credibility of the Supreme Court?
Well, I mean, the Supreme Court and the nominees should be held to the highest of standards. That's why it's called the Supreme Court. And what we saw on display was very partisan, and it's worrisome because it's supposed to be impartial. It's supposed to be nonpartisan. And that's the opposite of what we saw on display from Judge Kavanaugh. And meanwhile, you know, I think that it is so important to recognize the bravery that Dr. Ford displayed sharing her story in front of the world. And we have to believe survivors. And I wish that they would have taken the time to let the FBI investigation run a full course before moving forward.
As we think about that partisan environment, if elected, what areas do you think are important for you to work with the Trump administration on and to reach across the aisle to work with Republicans on with?
Well, beginning with infrastructure, I will happily work with President Trump and across the aisle. I will literally work with anyone to bring those infrastructure dollars back here to the 13th District. Because again, you know, for us, yes, it's our roads and bridges, but it's our waterways that need deepening and widening. It's our electrical grids that need modernizing. It's the digital divide that needs to be bridged. And we have so many needs here in our district. And I want to go and I want to work with anybody to bring those dollars back here.
I want to ask you, I'm going to end with the same question that I asked Representative Davis. Do you think we're better off as a country now than we were 2 years ago?
You know, what I hear from our neighbors and our community members around the district is that they don't like the divisiveness that this administration has really sowed. You know, that it's more of a divide and conquer strategy than unifying us. And part of the reason that I think it is so important to stand in front of your neighbors, you know, and I think it's unfortunate that Congressman Davis has refused to do town halls, because it's a responsibility of anybody seeking to represent their neighbors to stand in front of their neighbors and have a conversation. And no, we don't always agree. There's plenty of times that, you know, that people disagree with me. And that's fine. That's democracy. But that's also how we come to understand what is most important to everybody. And that's why I know that people throughout the district want me to stand up to protect their health care, because pre-existing conditions don't pick political parties. They want me to help bring down the cost of pharmaceutical drugs, because when they go to the doctor and the pharmacist to pick up their medicine, nobody's asking them if they pull a red ballot, a blue ballot, a green ballot. Those costs affect all of us. They all want me to stand up to protect their Social Security and Medicare. They all want their kids to get a good education. And these are their priorities, which makes them my priorities.
That's Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan. She is a candidate for the 13th Congressional District. Tomorrow night, I'll be moderating a debate between these two candidates. You can tune into 21stShow.org at 7 o'clock to hear it. Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan, thank you for being with me.
Thank you. It has been a pleasure. And I would just ask the listeners for their support on November 6th.
Support comes from the Center for Advanced Study, presenting a talk by Michelle Regenbetter from the Department of Psychology. Behavioral Decision Research meets Supercomputing, Wednesday, October 24th at noon at the Levis Faculty Center. More information is available at cas.illinois.edu.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Gareth Kennedy and Sarah Brown are Irish artists who've been working together under the name Kennedy Brown since 2005. Their work focuses on stories of 21st century capitalism. And in 2018, it's impossible to tell that story without thinking about the internet, smartphones, and social media. Those pieces are part of an exhibition called The Special Relationship. It's the duo's first display in the U.S., and it's at the University of Illinois' Krannert Art Museum until February 9th. Many of their pieces use the same cutting-edge technology that's becoming an even bigger part of our lives, including a 360-degree virtual reality headset. Curator Amy Powell showed us around the exhibit and the VR headset experience earlier this month, and we brought back a little audio postcard for you to listen.
I'm Amy Powell. I'm curator of modern and contemporary art at Krannert Art Museum, and this exhibition is Kennedy Brown, The Special Relationship. The Oculus, it's a 360-degree video on Oculus Go, and so it's really only visible to the person wearing it. And he takes you to, he's in Port Arlington, which is a small town in the middle of Ireland, where the government office charged with protection of privacy and data protection. So if anyone has a complaint against how data is being collected, they sort of take it to this office, but it's this tiny town in the middle of Ireland.
Hello there. You can call me Glaucon.
He is Glaucon, the figure from Plato's Republic, who stages a thought experiment.
Imagine you had a ring that would make you completely invisible. Once wearing this ring, you can act and behave in the world just as you like, with no accountability or no fear of reprisal.
And poses that as well for corporations. If a corporation were invisible, would they still be a moral actor? Which, of course, we recognize that story from Lord of the Rings, too.
But there's a catch to wearing a ring. When you wear it, you are invisible to other people. But there's another power somewhere else watching you. Every desire drops another cookie crumb. Everything you look at, everything you like, everywhere you go.
It's this kind of classical reference. It's a 360-degree video, and he sets up this thought experiment, and then he walks around until you're in front of this data protection commissioner's office.
This is the headquarters that governs use in Europe, the Middle East, Asia, and Africa. Basically everywhere except North America. This global community has 1.6 billion regular users. The responsibility of the corporation is expanding all the time. This is the power watching when you are wearing the ring. It is watching you even now.
That's some of the work of Kennedy Brown, The Special Relationship. With me now in studio are the two artists that make up Kennedy Brown, Gareth Kennedy and Sarah Brown. Amy Powell is also here with us. She's the curator of modern and contemporary art at the Cranard Art Museum. All of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So both of you have individual artistic practices, but together have collaborated for more than a decade. And Kennedy Brown is concerned with 21st century capitalism in the broadest sense, I think, not just economic implications, but technology and privacy. What first drew you all to this topic?
Broadly, it's the times we're living in, but also the kind of context of being educated in Dublin City and in Ireland, and just trying to get a handle on this kind of phenomenon of how Irish society has radically changed over the course of the last 20 years as Dublin being a node in global kind of capitalism.
And I think a lot of people might not be know as much about the role that Ireland and Dublin, I think we're particularly when we're talking about the current technological age that we live in and how much that affects our culture, our politics, and our daily life. And I wanted to just ask you about what your experience is specifically with technology and Dublin and the amount of the multinational corporations that are based there now.
I mean, I guess maybe it's useful to say that the title of the show is The Special Relationship, is part of how Gareth and I have been thinking about this relationship between like Ireland and the US, or the US as a kind of stand-in for the world, I suppose, as it is when you grow up in a small place. It's a political idea, but it's also an economic idea. And Kennedy Brown, in general, I think, is quite interested in this slippage between an economic discourse and a political discourse. And technology has increasingly become the way that that discourse is being pushed in Ireland. So things like corporate tax rates, and instead, as well as trying to bring people to like visit the small island, there's also a very serious set of economic policies that try to bring multinationals to settle in Ireland.
The year we've had, I mean, in many ways, the cat is out of the bag around issues of privacy and data collection and how that data is perhaps instrumentalized or monetized or commodified and is really, you know, something that's kind of mined from our everyday lives, and how this kind of so-called metadata then it goes on to have, let's say, real-world political and cultural effects. So there's that kind of element, and I suppose something we do is, as kind of Kennedy Brown, we're very interested in how do you access this opaque world, this complex world, this, how do you kind of make it human? How do you make it accessible or tangible? So a kind of technique we've drawn heavily on within the exhibition is this use of so-called redaction, which is kind of like a layering or a cutting, a pasting, a compositing of kind of material, we select online. And then this idea of avatars, getting that material to be performed by what is an actor, but we call them avatars in that they're a kind of digital embodiment of an idea or something. So I think that's a technique to try and make some of this opaque, complex world accessible. So it's a really big question of in these confused and confusing times. What kind of stories do we tell? What stories can we tell? And where those stories come from?
That's Gareth Kennedy. Sarah Brown is in studio with me, and we are talking about their exhibit, A Special Relationship, which is at the Cranard Art Museum now. I think this is your first survey at a museum in the U.S. I wonder how you would like your work to engage Americans specifically on issues around privacy, technology.
I think one of the really interesting things about the new work in particular is these kinds of ideas about free speech are so heightened in the US, and a lot of debates around free speech, freedom of expression, hate speech, how that should be regulated. I mean, a lot of those discussions have come from legal theory since the 1990s, and people like Judith Butler are talking about it. And there is a really strong connection to like US campuses as well. We feel that kind of placement of the work in a like in a university and in a campus museum is really significant. We're really interested to hear how students who, you know, we talk about some of the works being formed from a multilingual pool. You know, the people that are coming to see the show are also the people that are in the work. It's not really that Irish specific. The show is quite polyvocal. There's a lot of different nationalities. It's very, you know, diverse in all of the, in all senses of what that is. So we're kind of interested in what it feels like to come and see a show that you're in some way.
I would kind of address what we very much have in common. We all are very fortunate beneficiaries of living in democracies and having freedom of speech and having freedom of expression. So these are definitely things we have in common and can't take for granted. So what's key is to just have dialogue, you know, to kind of, and sometimes words aren't enough. So we have to kind of make art about some of these kind of issues and see how that becomes a proper structure to enhance dialogue.
Yeah, I mean, there's one work in the show, How Capital Moves, and it's made in the Polish language. And it kind of tracks a series of redundancies from a particular company and also rumours of redundancies and
so
fear
layoffs.
About redundancies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And one of the really interesting experiences we've had every time we show that work tends to be that people feel, they wonder if it's about their town, even if it's not shown in Poland. So that kind of sense of being able to recognise yourself in somebody else's experience or wonder, is there something common with this person that's speaking a language I've never heard before? That's something we would really like to build on and explore if that's an experience visitors might have in Cranert.
And I think it's really interesting how you all embrace technology as you are in some ways critiquing it. And I assume that's intentional.
Yeah, we're in the matrix, so to speak, to be kind of hackneyed about it. So yeah, we're implicated in this. We use technology. It's technology uses us. It's kind of colonized our everyday, and it's the kind of palette we've been given as artists in the 21st century to kind of work with this, but hopefully like to use it carefully and self with a self awareness and use it as a tool, as an instrument, not just as a folly, I suppose.
I mean, maybe something that is useful to mention is that the Real World Harm piece that's on 360 degree video, we had initially thought that would be a kind of more expanded number of experiences, and it's actually quite a short 5-minute piece. We probably won't work with that technology again, but we really wanted to experience it and occupy it fully in order to think through some of the problems that are very particular to it. Something that we do try to do is to make those conditions of use of the work very transparent and very available to people. So a kind of additional part of that is the printing of a disclaimer on the headset. And the disclaimer does the kind of slightly nerdy work of picking through the terms of service and highlighting some aspects that we feel are quite problematic, quite troubling.
That most people ignore.
That most, you know, that it's buried 20 pages down on the thing that you scroll through and you just click agree. And,
right, because
you know.
You're just trying to update your phone or
exactly.
install an application.
Agree.
Yeah, yeah. And it's done. So we kind of wanted to draw some of that discussion out by also using the technology.
We're not especially fond of wearing these things on our heads, you know. I mean, yeah.
They're quite discombobulating. But in terms of that terms of service, so actually what happens when you put on a headset like that is that your body is in one place and you might be having a very immersive experience that transports you somewhere else, but you're actually agreeing to not take a legal case against the company, for example. You're also agreeing that any dispute will be only between you and the company. You won't participate in any class action. And also that unless you happen to be using the device in Germany, even if we would use this device in Ireland, you're subject to Californian law. So very strange things actually happen when you start engaging with this device. And by making a work for this device, an artwork, but also making those terms of service very explicit to people, we wanted to kind of stage some of those contradictions and very strange legal situations that you're entering when you put it on.
So when you put it on, Glaucon, who's a well-spoken German man you meet in a small Irish town, he asks you specifically, is there such a thing as a harmless pleasure? And I suppose he's asking the question, but I suppose Kennedy Brown's very aware that the technology is not neutral. It's a place of power, control, jurisdiction. It's not outside of the realm of kind of politics or technology. Or
particularly because as you are in this realm, your data is being collected, how your body moves, how your eyes respond. All of this information is being being collected about you, even though you feel you're maybe very free or very transported elsewhere. You're being mapped as you wear it.
You're being harvested.
And I feel like we hear a lot in the United States, what's the big deal? I don't have anything to hide. I think we have a lot to learn from European history and experiences of different historical, cultural experiences of one's own privacy and what's taken and how it's used. And so I think the work raises some of those juxtapositions as well.
I think it's important to say that the company that acquired this headset in 2014, their CEO has famously said he doesn't believe in privacy, thinks privacy is a thing of the past. So that makes it incumbent upon ourselves to consider, well, what is important about privacy? What does having privacy protect? And what other kind of rights, fundamental rights, does right to privacy reinforce?
Because the right to privacy is personal, but it is also collective, and it does reinforce other fundamental rights like the freedom of expression, freedom of the press, all of these things that we know are really important for a collective democracy. So it isn't just an individual experience of privacy. It isn't really sufficient to just feel like, oh, well, I've nothing to hide, so it's not bad for me. There are greater implications for everyone else by one individual surrendering their privacy.
All of this is in a special relationship, which is an exhibit at the Cranard Art Museum. I want to thank curator Amy Powell and also Gareth Kennedy and Sarah Brown for being with me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Pamela.
Coming up after the break, Chicago has the worst recycling rate of any big city in the country, and a lot of it has to do with a company that marks recycling bins as contaminated when they don't have to be. We're going to dig into that story with the Better Government Association and learn how recycling systems across the state can improve. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Ever wonder what happens to your bottles, paper, and cans once you throw them in the recycling bin? Well, in the Chicago area, more often than not, it actually ends up in a landfill. That's according to the Better Government Association. Its new investigation has Chicago as the worst city for recycling in the country. In the report, the reporters looked at why this system has been so historically plagued, specifically one company, Waste Management, and that company's way of turning potential recycling into a profit. To explain more, we've got Madison Hopkins with us, an investigative reporter for the BGA on the line from Chicago. Also with us is Shantanu Pai, a researcher with the Illinois Sustainable Technology Center. He's also on the Illinois Recycling Association Board. Madison, Shantanu, thanks for being with me. Welcome to the 21st.
My pleasure.
Hi, thank you for having us. Really appreciate it.
Madison, so I wonder if we can just start with that big finding, because I think people think when they're recycling something that it's not going to end up in a landfill. Can you tell us, first of all, how the system is supposed to work?
Yes. So just to back up a little bit, you know, we looked at Chicago's system of recycling because back in 2011, when the mayor first came into office, he said he was going to revamp the way Chicago handles recycling and set up a managed competition to allow two private companies to pick up the recycling in certain areas of the city and the city sanitation crews to continue to service another area. And how it's supposed to work is they go and they see the blue carts, which are recycling bins in the city, and each driver has the authority to declare a bin contaminated if they say that it has some sort of trash in there, so food or plastic or other non-recyclables, when they're actually in your alley servicing your bin. And when that happens, they can put a tag on that bin, leave it behind, and let the regular city garbage crews come by to pick up and take the whole thing to a landfill, even if there's only one bad piece of non-recyclable materials in there.
And Shantanu, as Madison's talking about the whole idea of contamination, what does that include? I mean, I think the obvious thing would be if someone thinks like, oh, I have a dirty plastic container, like a mayonnaise bottle that has a lot of mayonnaise left in it. But what are we talking about here?
We're talking about a whole array of things here, from some communities, plastic bags as a contamination, chains, wood. There's a phenomenon called wish cycling. My mom does this all the time. She thinks something should be recycled and therefore puts it in the recycling bin. And that's the gamut of contamination. It's not just a dirty can or a dirty jar, which is sometimes not that much of an issue. We're talking about diapers, biohazardous waste, batteries, things that shouldn't be in the recycling or the trash end up in the recycling can because people just want it to be recycled. And some of our equipment just isn't handled or designed to handle that kind of waste.
And so, Madison, I think that that happens everywhere. What did you all find about how this works in Chicago, though, and the rate at which this is happening, particularly when it comes to this one company, Waste Management?
Yeah, so what we found is that, yes, while contamination is a problem nationwide, we looked at just how often blue carts were being declared contaminated in Chicago and found that the areas of the city that are serviced by one of the private contractors that's hired by the city, Waste Management, labels bins contaminated at a rate 20 times higher than those in the rest of the city. So that's interesting because when you think about contamination being an issue citywide, you wouldn't expect to see those stark differences. And what we looked into is that we found that because the city doesn't really give strict guidelines on how the driver should declare a bin contaminated. You know, is it that if there's one plastic bag, the whole bin should be declared contaminated, or should they filter out that one bag and pick up the good recyclables? They don't give those instructions. So it leaves the door open to kind of a wide variety of possible interpretations there. And why we found that was real. Oh, go ahead, sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, so you guys found that even though Waste Management only covers about half of Chicago, mostly on the northwest and far south sides, your investigation found that it's responsible for nearly 90% of the bins tagged as grossly contaminated since 2013?
Yes, exactly. And so those are pretty striking numbers. And we found that the other contractor hired by the city and the city sanitation crews that also handle parts of the city are just tagging bins at a much, much lower rate. And so it piqued our interest as to why that was going on. And when we looked into it, it got more interesting when we found out that Waste Management also had the contract with the city of Chicago to accept some of their garbage in their landfills, which would include some of those contaminated blue carts. So while both the contractors are paid to go out there and service the blue carts, regardless if they pick it up and process the recycling or if they just tag it as contaminated, Waste Management is also sometimes paid again to accept those same materials in their landfill.
So they're paid twice?
In certain cases, yes. The city doesn't exactly track where the blue bins go once they're contaminated and mixed in with the overall garbage stream. But Waste Management is one of five companies that accepts landfilling, that accepts trash in their landfills. So, yeah, it's likely they're getting paid twice in at least some of these cases, which, you know, could be looked at as a financial incentive for them to declare a bin contaminated.
Right. So essentially, if they're going to get paid, they actually get paid more if they don't recycle it, it sounds like.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. And so the volume in which we're talking about this here, when we're thinking about the volume of this trash, I read something in your story that basically it's enough blue carts to basically completely fill Wrigley Field. Is that the volume of waste that we're talking about?
Yes. Yeah, so that's the way we looked at it because, again, since the city doesn't track a lot of information about the contents of these contaminated blue carts, it's hard to say, you know, exactly how many tons of real recycling versus trash are in each of these. But if you're just looking at the blue carts, Waste Management tagged more than 500,000 since mid-2013. So, yes, that would be enough to completely fill Wrigley Field, is the calculation we did.
Go ahead, Shantanu.
Sorry,
yeah, go ahead.
I've been studying about waste and recycling for a better part of 5 years now. And the challenge we have is, as researchers and city planners, is data on what happens to waste has been consistently hard to find, as opposed to electricity and water, other sustainability metrics. So we're almost always going back to volumes and larger macro level data. So it's hard to tell why some regions are better or worse in recycling. And so the motive is really interesting to tease out, but it's just that we've never had that level of consistent data. And as tagging and as we modernize the recycling industry, we'll start getting better data. And this is one example of we've seen a trend now, and there are questions to be answered on why this exists and why these regions or these spaces in Chicago have more tags or less tags.
But can you just remind us, Shantanu, why this is so bad in terms of these are potentially recyclable items that are in fact becoming trash?
Right. So in the interest of time, the problem is twofold. Our packaging waste or our recyclable material has been getting lighter and lighter. We've moved away from glass and steel as a mode to transport materials to light and lighter plastics. To give an example, a water bottle in the early 2000s to a water bottle today, a plastic single-use water bottle, that weighs half the amount. Or just the plastic bottle itself weighs half of it. So to collect a ton of recycling or a metric ton of recycling, we need to collect a lot more of stuff than we used to in the early 2000s when most of this infrastructure was built. So the increased contamination creates a burden on the quality and cost effectiveness of recycling.
Hmm.
But more importantly...
And then also there are also things that are ending up in a landfill too.
Right. And more importantly, it's a safety risk. Plastic bags, biohazardous materials that end up in a material recovery facility or a recycling facility, those pose significant risks to the human health and safety of people that work there. So it's important that people remember what is recyclable and what isn't. And the easiest way to find that is on your city's website.
And I want to get to that in a second. Madison, can I just ask you first, though, what Waste Management has said, what the city of Chicago has said since this BGA investigation has been published?
Sure. Yeah, we talked with Waste Management and the city quite a bit in the lead up to the story, and they haven't come out with anything since then. But their big argument, counter argument, I guess, to our findings was that contamination is a problem nationwide, you know, just like we've been talking about just now. And that's true. But again, what we point out is we understand that contamination is a problem. We understand people need to be better educated about what is and is not recyclable. But why are we seeing these big differences in, you know, one city block's difference between where Waste Management services it versus where the other private contractor does?
And what has the city said about that?
That they haven't undertaken a comprehensive analysis on the data, even though the data that we used to build our investigation was received from the city. So they haven't looked into it yet, but they're more focused, as they've said, on a broad-ranging approach towards contamination, which mainly centers on better educating the residents and not as much on looking at what the contractors are doing on the pickup side.
So, Shantanu, for people who are listening throughout the state, you said go to their city's website. I have to tell you, I've done that. I once was on, I was on the city of Champaign's website for like half an hour one day trying to figure out if I could recycle envelopes that had the plastic window on them, and I couldn't find an answer. So how do you suggest people know whether or not they're actually recycling things properly? Because sometimes the symbol isn't super helpful, right?
Mm-hmm. So I would suggest, and I know this is a hard answer, but because recycling is so diverse in what can get recycled in your locality, and the reasons are many compared to, like, the density of your city defines what can be recycled because they need to make sure what is recyclable. But oddly enough, the city of Urbana has a good list, and if you're wondering for Urbana and Champaign, that list is pretty similar for both cities, other than a few differences. In the city of Champaign in specific, though, because you service recycling through your waste hauler, should be able to tell you what's. So if you go to the waste haulers, the person
So that's what you have to do. So basically, you have to figure out, if we have folks who are listening in cities all across Illinois, they need to figure out who their recycler is and if it's also done by their waste hauling company or if it's a separate recycling contract. That's number one.
Correct. And then if it's a city like Urbana where the city contracts for you in a franchise agreement, their website should have one.
Okay. And in general, what should people know about contamination? I guess you should figure out, first of all, what I learned from your story is in Chicago, plastic bags are considered contamination. So even if you put your recycling in a plastic bag, that's considered contamination. That could vary also depending on what municipality you're in, Shantanu.
That is correct. Yep. But the simple things that I would like to let people know is stay away from hazardous waste. Don't put electronics in your recycling bin. There are other ways for those things. And stay away from plastic bags. If you do want to recycle your plastic bags, most grocery stores across the state will accept them at their front door.
Madison, what's next for what you guys are doing with this investigation?
We're hoping to really continue along this line of reporting just to dig into it further. We still have a lot of unanswered questions, mainly about the financing of this program, because, you know, as I mentioned in the beginning, they really promised that with the use of these private contractors, they're going to revamp recycling in Chicago. We've now looked at the actual recycling end of it and seen there's big problems with it. So now we're interested in looking at how it's affecting taxpayers as well, along with, you know, other aspects of recycling in the city. Chicago, like many other cities, only provides residential pickup to smaller residential buildings. And it's also required by law for larger residential buildings to recycle, but we'd like to look into how effective those requirements have been.
Regardless, for everyone listening, it's a good reminder to think about what they're doing when it comes to recycling and make sure they're recycling the correct things and to talk to your municipality about it. If you want to read more about what's happening in Chicago, we will tweet out the link to Madison's story. Again, I want to thank Madison Hopkins, an investigative reporter with the Better Government Association in Chicago. I also want to thank Shantanu Pai, an assistant sustainability researcher with the Illinois Sustainable Technology Center. Guys, thanks for being with me.
Thanks so much for having
us.
Bye-bye.
That's all the time we have for today. Coming up on tomorrow's program, Governor Rauner has apologized for the first time to the families who lost loved ones due to the Legionnaires outbreak in the state-run Quincy Veterans Facility. We'll hear about how many of them are doing almost a year later from WBZ reporters Tony Arnold and Dave McKinney. We'll also get the latest on the investigation that has been launched into this outbreak by State Attorney General Lisa Madigan. You can always head to our website, 21stshow.org, for more information about the program. That's where we've got past shows. We've got all of our election coverage wrapped up there as well. Just head to 21stshow.org. That's also how you can find information about how to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or how to follow us on social media. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Vishesh Anand is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Moore. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.